Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your humble host is grateful for listener support like Mary Ann Crawford from Seattle, Washington, a regular contributor to the program. You can sign up for our voluntary subscription as little as $5 a month at peterbcollins.com. Check out the words to this song. It's Neil Young, and it's called Living with War. Invested in the campaign of Barack Obama around ending the war in Iraq, and many progressives just kind of swallowed hard and ignored what Obama said during the campaign about doubling down in Afghanistan. And he's doing what he said. Right now, there is this great debate inside the Obama administration about really how many more troops to put into Afghanistan. There are a range of options being considered, but one that is not there is pulling out. And today we talk with Tom Hayden, former California state senator, longtime peace activist. He put his life on the line back in the Vietnam era in Chicago and paid for it dearly. He was one of the Chicago 8 or 10, depending on how you count that. Tom Hayden, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show today.
Thanks, Peter. I'm glad to join you in your new venture.
Well, it's working out really well, and it's exciting because I no longer have to go through corporate gatekeepers at Clear Channel and other radio chains.
Mm-hmm. And I remember those.
Yeah, we're reaching listeners directly, and it's really gratifying. So I'm very pleased. You published an opinion piece in the L.A. Times on November 10th with the headline, Why Die for Karzai? And I wanted to get your thoughts because it's a little fluid right now, or at least that's the perception that some people have, with Ambassador Eikenberry, former military leader of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, saying, hey, don't send more troops here. There's nothing to build around. And it seems that some people got their hopes up momentarily when Obama seemed to wave off the four options that were presented, but then on further reporting, we learned that he said, well, I want you to try to cobble them all together and pick the best elements of the four
right.
plans that were being presented. And as I stated in the intro, the idea of pulling out or even scaling back is not among the options being considered right now. So where do you think things stand right now, Tom? And in a minute, I want to ask you where progressives ought to be putting their energies.
Well, I wouldn't hazard a guess. These are all reports of rumors, and they're interesting. But it does seem to me that a couple of things have happened that are really verifiable. I mean, one is we sent a lot of troops over there, supposedly to protect the presidential election, which was found by all observers to be completely completely corrupt and a fraud. So from the point of view of U.S. policy, counterinsurgency or otherwise, you do have to have a client state, an ally, a friend. There's nothing there except the Karzai government. And so a lot of Americans have died for the Karzai government, essentially, about 50 a month since President Obama sent these new troops over earlier this year. So that should give him pause. And secondly, as you pointed out, Peter, the Eikenberry letter, there's obviously some little power scandal, power competition between Eikenberry and McChrystal, because Eikenberry was moved out, McChrystal was moved in. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, Obama can accurately say, hey, the generals themselves disagree. One of them, Eikenberry, is apparently against any further troop increase, and he may go further than that. So this presents the president with an option, which would call an exit strategy, and we'll see what he does. He's certainly taken his sweet time. And I don't remember any occasion like this where there was a secret debate scheduled at appointed public times going over so many weeks as this one.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's contrast this process with what Bush used to deceive us when he wanted to surge more troops into Iraq. And I am not one of those people who believe the surge worked as it was defined and described, but nonetheless, he convened a bunch of his dad's old pals, including the current Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who Obama held over, to the Iraq Study Group. And they painstakingly met and put together a series of proposals that were completely ignored by Bush. And so, in this case, the other thing is that Bush, throughout his wartime tenure, kept saying, well, we don't let politics decide these things. It's the generals on the ground.
Right.
Well, he kept selecting generals on the ground until he got one who would ask him for what he wanted to hear. So
apparently, yes.
Obama's a little different. He sacked McKiernan and put in McChrystal and didn't apparently talk to McChrystal very much over the last few months, except for apparently addressing down on the runway in Copenhagen. And so it's interesting that McChrystal then leaked his proposal to try to, I guess, leverage that with Washington politicians and the Lieberman wing of whatever party he's in. And so the process is somewhat different, but I'm afraid we're going to get the same result, that the president's going to make a decision to put more American troops into an occupied country that we have no hope of turning around.
Well, I don't disagree with that. I just, again, I think it's speculative. I mean, the main thing is that not much of an anti-war movement in an organized sense. About 70% of Democrats oppose escalation and oppose the policy as presented, and a slight majority of all Americans. So Obama and his advisors have to be looking at that political fact. Does he want to go forward the next couple of years in a conflict with the rank-and-file base of his own party and public opinion, which could become a nightmare replay of his having become an anti-war, starting as an anti-war presidential candidate and launched his campaign against Iraq. I'm not saying somebody will run against him, but it must give him a lot to worry about, because a large cohort of the people that supported Obama did so for reasons of hope. They were volunteers by the tens of thousands. They poured in millions of dollars in contributions. And at the rate things are going, they won't be there for his congressional candidates this next year.
Right.
And they may not be for him. They may not be there for him, because they're entirely mobilized around, their impulse, their aspirations. They're not like cogs in a machine. Machine orders them to vote, they go vote. Well, those days are past. So he's got a lot to worry about besides these arguments over, what kind of counterinsurgency or counterterrorism approaches. He's got the fundamental fact that, this war is perceived as kind of a quagmire by most people in his party already. The Democratic Party of the state of California executive board, a very large body, this weekend passed yet another resolution denouncing the war, and those resolutions are just paper, but they go around the internet. They go to other states, and they're a reflection for the White House of where their party is at, and it's not with escalation.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just dismissed the idea, or at least marginalized the idea, of a progressive running against Obama in 3 years. But I think it would be healthy for progressives to identify a potential candidate and start to rally around that person, if only to send a powerful message to Obama, who spent so much time kissing up to the right that he can no longer afford to ignore his base. He ignored us on single-payer health care, and we've seen this whole process devolve into, an exercise in largely in futility. We see that he has extended some of the really bad law and presidential power grabs of the previous administration, particularly noting that our Fourth Amendment rights have not been returned. The wiretapping, eavesdropping, interception of our emails and telecommunications continues unabated. And while he is struggling to close Guantanamo and deal with the thorny issues that Bush created there, we know that the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan is a gulag that has more than 800 inmates, most of whom were not detained in Afghanistan originally, and who operate under the same murky non-rules, that they're not charged and they're held indefinitely. And so on these core issues for progressives, in addition to the war points that you made earlier, Obama has ignored the very people who helped him win the primary against Hillary Clinton.
I feel like you're giving the answers to your questions, Peter. I'm not going to go there. I think you may be proven right over the next few months, such a development may unfold. At the moment, I don't think it would be useful for me to be trying to pressure President Obama, the White House, congressional leadership, and at the same time encouraging somebody to run against them. It gets too political. But these things can't be controlled by anyone. If he does antagonize the grassroots base of the party over the next year or two, sure, just like the sun coming up, candidates will look it over, and candidates may emerge. My role, I think, is to warn that Afghanistan could threaten the best parts of his domestic agenda, because it's a $1 trillion war, and I can spell that out for you if you like, on top of another $1 trillion war, Iraq. You just can't afford a $1 trillion health care program and a couple of $1 trillion wars, and not to mention investments in energy alternatives and the rest of it. It could also capsize his presidency, because he takes the social movements for granted to such an extent that it opens space for somebody within the Democratic Party or independently to run against them and siphon off some votes. And the next election is going to be very, very close for him, and he can't afford the loss of numbers and the loss of enthusiasm that came from so many people of color, young people, old-time progressives, 60s people. He's got to be thinking about it, and I'm glad that you're raising the questions.
So tell me what your thoughts are about the way the very people who supported Obama have acted politically over this past year. Because I have created language here for this that helps me describe it. You recall that Reagan was referred to as the Teflon president, And I suggest that DuPont has come up with a new and improved product called Leflon. And Obama sprays it on, and nothing from the left sticks. And it really seems that people have been very quiet about these war issues. During the first 6 months in particular, there was barely a peep about Iraq and only minor discussion about Afghanistan. I'm gratified that at least there is somewhat of a debate about our policies vis-a-vis Afghanistan. But it seems that the president feels that he does not need to address his base. He doesn't need to, reach out to and offer policy gains to the very people who got him elected.
Well, again, you're answering your own questions. My answers would be different. It seems to me the focus on Obama needs to be in the context of a focus on what has been revealed about the whole power structure, the military, banking community, inside and outside the administration, the Senate being dominated by troglodytes or whatever you want to call them, people from states with no people, mm-hmm. determining whether or not we have a health care bill. I think it sort of reminds me of, I had an interview with President Jimmy Carter in the White House back in the 80s, and I took the opportunity to ask him this question. Mr. President, do you think that the unelected heads of banks and corporations have more power than the elected president of the United States, that is yourself? He looked at me in that honest Jimmy Carter way, and he said, I learned that my first year in office. And I think this is the learning process that's going on with Barack Obama. Where it goes, anyone knows, but we have to give full-throated support to the anti-war movement, to the single-payer healthcare movement, to the implementation of much stronger energy conservation, anti-global warming policies, and create pressure on our own. And you say that people have been awfully quiet. I think that that's whether we like it or not, that's the natural rhythm when people give a year or two of their lives on a presidential campaign. They're exhausted, mm-hmm. and they hope, against hope sometimes, that the president will come through without any further pressure, any further activity. But those attitudes, I think, are diminishing, if not long gone, and you've seen a lot of action about the healthcare issue, and as soon as that's disposed of one way or the other, I think Afghanistan will occupy an even bigger part of the public agenda, and with elections coming as rapidly as they do, I think people need to be building a base in congressional districts, building a base around an exit strategy from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and in the Bay Area, I'm speaking Thursday night to the Wellstone Democratic Club somewhere in Berkeley or Oakland, and mm-hmm. there are very important people there. Congresswoman Barbara Lee has got a proposed legislation to cut off any funding for a troop escalation. Congresswoman Woolsey is there from the Progressive Caucus. It's quite a John Burton has been a leading voice against Afghanistan in the California Democratic Party. It's unfortunate that our two senators, both from the Bay Area, have been pretty much missing in action on these anti-war issues, and I wish that there was some way to get their attention, but I think they're going to come around at a late and convenient hour rather than being out there on the front lines of this debate.
Well, I think that certainly describes Senator Feinstein's path in the past, but I would invest a little more in Barbara Boxer.
I haven't seen anything to invest in. Yeah. From the point of view of ending the war in Afghanistan. That's all. She's an old friend. I admire her. I'm very glad she's there. I'm glad she chairs that committee. All good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I noticed during the Iraq War and on into this one that she invests very little energy in it. She's worried about something. I don't know what. She did come around to support Senator Feingold's legislation, but, you know, 3-4 years late, as I recall. And mm-hmm. she hasn't been heard from on Afghanistan.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Not that I know. I could be wrong, but if she's listening, I hope that she'll, you know, pay close attention to the fact that California Democrats are in favor of an exit strategy. That means power-sharing arrangements, negotiations with the Taliban, a timeline for troop withdrawal, the replacement of NATO troops. What are they doing in Asia anyway?
Mm-hmm.
Replacement of NATO troops with designated troops from countries with Muslim majorities. Those sort of things are going to have to happen sometime. But if it's put off for just the next 2 years, for example, at the rate of American death under President Obama this summer through now, you'll have 1,100 more American dead. And I don't know the multiple, but there have been 300 wounded, the highest number of Americans wounded in Afghanistan just in the past 3 months. You multiply that out during the next 2 years, which the Pentagon claims will be the time of hard fighting, hard combat. That means over 1,000 more American deaths and many thousands of wounded on top of the 700 deaths that occurred under Bush. The cost of that is going to be $1 trillion over an 8-year period if Obama's president for 8 years. And these are facts that just have to be considered when people are pursuing their wild dreams of dominance, or, you know, that we can throw our weight around, or we can afford any kind of combat anywhere in the world. We're going to police the world. It's just coming to a cold, hard conclusion. We cannot afford, we cannot sustain these wars, especially in the absence of any tax revenue to pay for them,
mm-hmm.
without giving up the domestic agenda that we care about and that the president cares about. So it's kind of on a lesser scale at the moment, like Lyndon Johnson choosing between the war in Vietnam and the Great Society, no?
Yeah. It's an interesting crossroads, and
sure
certainly
is.
We can't afford it all. And also, even if we wanted to borrow more money from China to pay for it, it's a bad investment. It's throwing, you know, good lives and good money after bad.
Correct. That's correct. With no end, no particular end in sight. They're not even talking about, like, defeating the Taliban and the insurgents we're fighting. They're talking about derailing Al-Qaeda and anybody that is a host to Al-Qaeda, but Al-Qaeda's not in Afghanistan.
Right.
So you figure. This is a very smart president, and I'm sure he's asking a lot of questions, and I wonder what he thinks when he walks away into the silence of his inner sanctum
mm-hmm.
after listening to these advisors go on and on and on about unsustainable, unachievable, unaffordable proposals.
Well, and if you take a look at the record of President Obama's statements about Afghanistan over the last 10 or 11 months, at different times he's articulated most of the reservations or objections that can be expressed. You know, that this is a...
Right. I don't understand that, do you? I just don't understand... perhaps it's a way of introducing things into the national conversation without making a presidential commitment to them. But he talks, on the one hand, about this being the right war, the good war, right? That's a big mistake. And then he says, of course, we need an exit strategy. Well, if it's that essential, you wouldn't want an exit strategy. You'd want victory.
Yeah.
But it's this total ambivalence. It's not a mistake. It's correct war, it's a good war, and we have to get out as soon as possible. There's conflicting drums going on in this president's head here, and I do think, I said I wouldn't predict, but it would be typically presidential for him to propose more troops to focus on Pakistan especially,
mm-hmm.
And more drones, and an exit strategy. So as to tell the military, don't come back next year telling me you need 10,000, 20,000, 50,000 more troops to finish the job. This is the last call.
Mm-hmm.
And does that make any sense? Not to me, but certainly it would reflect the polar opposite forces sitting around that table in the Situation Room.
Mm-hmm. Tom, I want to take a little side trip here because you mentioned the drones, and I was struck by the question that a Pakistani female student posed and then followed up on with Secretary Clinton.
What was it? Say it again. What was the?
Well, she equated the drones with terrorism, and she said that it's a way of killing people who have been declared guilty without any trial or process. And, you know, the secretary, Hillary Clinton, just pointedly refused to address her remarks. I mean, she kind of blithely said, well, there's a war going on. But she wouldn't even acknowledge that we use the drones or, you know, the political consequences of that decision. And I think that, number one, it's an important question, and I'm glad that this young Pakistani woman asked it. She deserves an answer. And I point out that our American media has yet, I have not seen a reporter pose that question to the president, the defense secretary, or anybody else in the chain of command.
Well, I think here the anti-war movement, such as it is, could step in. There are protests going on in Nevada and considered at the RAND Corporation down here and other places around the country where research on these unmanned surveillance vehicles or drones with names like, you know, the Predator and mm-hmm. so on, is going on, the contradiction is this: on the one hand, the administration does promise more transparency, but the entire war in Pakistan is being run in secret. We don't know. It comes to a point where the Secretary of State has to deny that there are these unmanned vehicles up in the sky dropping bombs on people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's surreal. And then you have an overall commander in Afghanistan, Pakistan, McChrystal, that's a general whose entire career in Iraq remains classified because all he did was run secret operations. And that means extrajudicial killings. That means knocking down doors at night. That means he probably is the one that set up the initial detention camps in 2003 in violation of the Geneva Agreements, because you're supposed to tell the Red Cross who you have and
mm-hmm.
so on. And
mm-hmm.
So you've got a war that is increasingly shrouded in secrecy. I'm not saying it's the same as Bush, because Bush was kind of making things up, like the weapons of mass destruction. Wolfowitz said, well, that was the only thing we could agree on, so that became the that became the reason we gave the public. But there's a fine line between making things up and keeping things secret, and both are bad. And the issue that perhaps ought to really be focused on is to get the media to begin now to tackle the secrecy issue. They certainly learned their lesson in Iraq, and they ought to tackle this issue head-on. Congressional hearings should tackle it head-on. I'll give you a specific example. A question was posed by Senator Kerry and answered by the Pentagon, but the answer remains confidential. Senator Kerry has not released the answer. This is at hearings a couple months ago. And the question was this: During the Iraq War, during the Republican administration, when Rumsfeld and Cheney were in there, it was reported in the New York Times that there were calculations made on every aerial attack, every bombing, of how many civilian casualties were tolerable. In other words, there was no accident here. Mm-hmm. It was, if it was over 50, there had to be a sign-off by the Secretary of Defense. So they knew, based on their mathematical projections, how many civilians could be expected to be killed in each bombing attack. And they had protocols. And I don't know what then happened. The issue went away for a while, but it was posed by Senator Kerry's Armed Services Committee. Foreign Relations Committee staff. It was answered, and then they classified the answer. So just Kerry's been evolving in a somewhat positive direction here, but why is he keeping it secret if the truth is that these casualties are not accidental at all? They're intentionally accepted based on what's a tolerable body count of civilians. Or they could say, no, we don't do that anymore. That would be immoral. That's out of policy. No, we're not doing that. But if that were the case, why would it be a secret?
Mm-hmm.
Why no answer?
And, Tom, for me, the greatest concern is about the stability of Pakistan and the control over its nuclear weapons. And I'm sure that's a high priority in the Obama administration. But it strikes me, again, that adding more troops to Afghanistan will not help us with the Pakistani problem. And I know they're neighbors, but you don't just pop over because of the rugged terrain and also because of the sovereignty and cultural issues. And so it strikes me that we need a plan that has some public transparency about how we are going to sustain the government in Pakistan, help it in its battle against the Taliban and the other insurgent forces. It's not all just one, unified group. And, try to see that country through, because I think that represents the greatest risk to the region and the greatest risk in that region to the United States.
Well, I think you're on the path of another great question. I don't disagree with what you've said. It's almost as if somebody wants to destabilize Pakistan. First, we supported Musharraf, a dictator, military dictator, with $11 billion after 9/11, and he was obviously with the Pakistani military running operations in and out of Afghanistan, supportive of the insurgents and the Taliban, because they see Afghanistan as a buffer zone in the proxy war between Pakistan and India.
Correct.
And we're on India's side, and trying to convince Pakistan that they're mistaken and that India is their true friend in the long run, and their enemies are the Pakistani Taliban, it's an argument that isn't going to work. So I think that we're on the path to destabilizing Pakistan further. It's altogether possible that it will devolve into civil strife and a Balkanization of Pakistan, with Balochistan spinning off as an independent area. And then your question comes up, what's the secret plan already adopted by the administration in the case of Pakistan becoming so destabilized that the nukes could fall into the hands of people who would really want to use them? Somewhere there is such a secret plan. obviously, and we don't know what it is, but we should be urging that it never get to that point, period. It seems to me one possible alternative, which is not being considered, is Obama and the U.S. being serious mediators over the India-Pakistan quarrel. That's what's underlying all this. As long as it seems that the United States is on the side of India, then, you know, obviously Pakistan cares more about the settlement and the disposition of the Kashmir question than anything else. And if suddenly we said we're going to help you on Kashmir, they might be much more cooperative on other issues like civil liberties or cooperation with the United States. But we seem to want it all.
Yeah.
They have gone to, I forget the casualty counts, but I think there have been three wars with hundreds of thousands of people killed and wounded over Kashmir.
Mm-hmm.
And is that ever mentioned in the U.S. commentary?
No. It would just confuse people, you know?
Well, do people know that India does have close links with the Northern Alliance, that India has consulates all over Afghanistan, that India is building roads in Afghanistan, that Pakistan is not nuts to perceive Indian intrusion in Afghanistan under the U.S.-led coalition.
Mm-hmm.
So when you ask them, why don't they, you know, pull back from supporting the insurgents, I'm sure their response in their conversations with Washington is, well, why don't you pull back your support for India? Give us a guarantee, and why don't we settle the Kashmir issue?
Mm-hmm.
They won't do that.
Yeah. Well, Tom Hayden, I want to thank you for joining us. And just to sum up, do you believe that the best way that progressives can express themselves right now is through the progressives in the House, Barbara Lee and Lynn Woolsey? I'm not seeing very much support in the Senate other than Carl Levin raising questions about adding more troops. Feingold?
Yeah, I think Feingold is the key person in the Senate. And if Kerry ever begins to move, they could be quite a combination. But in the meantime, you know, there's books to read, articles to study, research to be done, community meetings. Maybe people want to pick up the issue of drones and predators if research is going on in their community. The way this is going to end is through people power against the pillars of the policy. So number one, you want to convince the undecided that this is a bad idea, bad war. Number two, you want to work with the groups that are affected by the cost of the war but don't realize it. Senior citizens, healthcare advocates, environmentalists, they're on the sidelines of the anti-war movement, but they're going to feel the impact of the budgetary expenditures on war. Number three, you've got to keep up the efforts to keep the Pentagon from snatching away young men and women at the recruiting headquarters. And we've got to talk about the cost of the war, including the cost of the hospitalization, the Walter Reed, the higher suicide rates, the rising problems of psychological crisis that you see reflected in the events at Fort Hood. Those are the kind of things that people should be focused on. And if they do focus and build pressure, the administration will follow. But waiting for a politician is not what I would recommend. I say that as a former politician.
And that's advice well heard. Tom Hayden, thank you very much for joining me today.
Take care, Peter. Bye-bye.
Good to talk with you. We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink fine organic wine. Try the fine earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since way back in the last century. click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com. There's a very special introductory offer just for you. Former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman returns to our program today. His legal nightmare continues despite the change in administration and the hope that many of us invested in the changeover from Bush to Obama. Governor, welcome back to our program.
Peter B. Collins, I'm delighted to be with you and your listeners today. Thanks so much for having me back on.
Well, I'm delighted to talk with you, but troubled that the problems continue and that Eric Holder, the new attorney general, has not seen fit to give you any kind of a break or any kind of relief. And just the quick thumbnail, Don Siegelman was elected to statewide office in Alabama five times, and his last election was stolen from him. He went to bed the winner, woke up the loser the next day, and that was just the beginning of his problems. Karl Rove's friends railroaded him into not one but two prosecutions. The first one fell apart. The second one resulted in a federal jail term for Don Siegelman. He served some time and then was released on bail to pursue his appeals, and those appeals have been working their way up. But at the appeals court in Atlanta last year, he didn't get the relief he sought, and in some ways they kind of dug things in a little deeper. And, Governor, recent developments, we saw the Justice Department decide not to pursue a retrial of Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, which was very generous on the part of Attorney General Holder. Why is it that you can't get a break? And I'm not asking for, you know, some secret lever pulling or something like that. An honest reading of your case and the judge who should have recused himself, many of the other issues, including the nature of the alleged crime, it just screams for review and justice.
Well, yeah, let me say two things at the outset. One, you're absolutely right. Now, we're not asking for special treatment. We're asking for fair play. We're asking for a level playing field. And that's what Congress, I mean, the United States Congress, through the chairman and members of the House Judiciary Committee, have written not once but three letters to the U.S. Attorney Generals, from beginning with Gonzalez, Casey, and now Eric Holder, only asking that they investigate the alleged prosecutorial or government misconduct in my case, which, as you said, screams out for somebody who is not invested in the outcome to conduct a critical review. As Chairman Conyers said in his letter of the 25th of September, he said, you know, we're just asking for somebody with fresh eyes who's not invested in this conviction to conduct this critical review. Let me back up. Second thing is, I think it's important for your listeners to know that, to get just a flavor of this, because I was running for re-election, and I am being pursued by the wife, pursued legally. Mm-hmm. She was a U.S. attorney, pursued by the wife of my Republican opponent, campaign manager.
Right.
And let me repeat that. My Republican opponent's campaign manager was married to the U.S. attorney who indicted me and brought me to trial 1 month before my reelection campaign. I mean, you don't have to be too, you know, mm-hmm. you don't have to, there are not a lot of dots to connect here.
That campaign manager named Bill Canary was a longtime partner in campaign politics with Karl Rove.
Oh, absolutely. Business partner, political partner, they worked together for two decades.
Mm-hmm.
When people say, well, why would Karl Rove give a rip about Siegelman in Alabama? Well, one, you just made the connection, Bill Canary. But after the 92 election, when President Bush, Hubert Walker, lost to Bill Clinton, Karl Rove and Bill Canary came to Alabama. They both married girls from Alabama. Karl Rove married a girl from Mobile, and Bill Canary married a girl who was working for the state attorney general's office named Laura Canary. And Rove settled on the Gulf Coast at a place called Rosemary Beach, where he lives today. They partnered and ran campaigns out of Alabama to take over the Alabama Supreme Court on behalf of the Alabama Business Council. Bill mm-hmm. Canary then became president of the Business Council. Rove went off to run George W.'s campaign. But I did battle with Karl Rove beginning in 1994, when he was trying to steal his first election for the state Supreme Court. I did battle with him again in 1998 when I was running for governor, and he was working for the state attorney general who opened this investigation up on me. Then we did battle again in 2000 and 2002 when he and Jack Abramoff funneled a bunch of money into Alabama and, as you mentioned, stole the election.
Mm-hmm.
The two people who took credit for stealing the election, by the way, Peter, one was Karl Rove's partner, and the other was an employee who worked for Jack Abramoff. I mean, yeah, again, it does. You don't have to be too well connected to politics. When you hear the name Jack Abramoff, it ought to raise an antenna. When you hear the name Karl Rove's partner, people ought to think, well, something's up.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, because of the opposition I was getting from the Karl Rove's client, the Attorney General, for a recount, I decided I would just live the fight another day and run for re-election 4 years later. And you know, if they wanted to steal this election, there wasn't anything I could do about it because they weren't going to give me a recount. So I set out to run for re-election in 2006. As I was preparing to run for re-election, an investigation was started, and as I told you, the wife of Karl Rove's best friend in Alabama brought me to trial 1 month before my election. I was convicted of something, folks, that nobody else in this country has ever been charged with, and that is I appointed a contributor to an all-volunteer board. In this case, this gentleman had been on this board through three previous governors, two Republicans, one Democrat. I was the fourth governor to reappoint this guy to the same place he had served through three previous administrations.
Mm-hmm.
There was no evidence, zero evidence, of an express quid pro quo. Even the 11th Circuit said no such language, no such testimony.
And the contribution didn't go into your own political campaign.
No.
It was a campaign you were running to pass a state lottery.
Exactly, so our kids could get a free college education. What's interesting is, something that's not been brought out, is while I was trying to raise money for the lottery, my opponent, the Republican, whose campaign manager was married to the prosecutor, right? They are funneling millions of dollars through Jack Abramoff and Ralph Reed, the president of the Christian Coalition at that time. They were funneling millions of dollars from the Indian casino owners in Mississippi into Alabama to defeat me. These are not my charges. These were charges that were leveled at Jack Abramoff by United States Senator John McCain, a Republican, which gives this whole thing a bit of credibility. So here I am. I'm trying to raise money for the lottery, and Abramoff and his gang, Rove and folks, are funneling millions of dollars in to defeat me. I get investigated and indicted and convicted on appointing this guy to this all volunteer board. Sentenced to prison, hauled off in shackles and handcuffs, and put in solitary confinement at the maximum security prison, and then finally released 9 months later. I'm out on bond, and I'm now facing I'm at the end of the runway legally. I'm appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court, and hopefully the United States Supreme Court will hear my case. What got us started on this conversation was the fact that the Department of Justice is opposing my effort to get this important issue heard by the United States Supreme Court. Keep in mind that if I can be convicted of appointing a contributor, then what kind of impact does that have on the American political system?
Let's trot out every person who's been appointed ambassador in the last 30 years.
Yeah, or we could start with President Obama and his recent appointments where he appointed people who raised $500,000 to various positions, various ambassadorships. But the point is, you know, people may not like politics the way it is, but unless people trade a position for money, which is illegal, then simply appointing your friends who are qualified or appointing people who support you when you run for office or voting in favor of legislation that is also supported by a contributor is not a crime. unless there is a deal struck saying, if you give me this money, I'll vote in favor of your legislation. That's
right.
Clearly wrong. That's a crime. That never happened in this case. What the courts have said is, now, there doesn't have to be an express deal. The juries can infer that there was a deal by the fact that the guy made a contribution and you appointed him. Well, if we do that, then we've changed the face of politics in this country forever, because nobody would be able to contribute, and candidates wouldn't, or elected officials wouldn't be able to do anything for anybody to help them in their campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we are on that. The reason why the Department of Justice is still opposing my release, the reason why the Department of Justice has not done for me what they did for the Republican senator from Alaska, is not because I am not deserving of it. It is because the same Karl Rove, George Bush prosecutors are not only in control of my case in Montgomery, Alabama, they're still in control of the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., because they haven't been removed.
Well, this is a critical problem. There was an analysis in the New York Times over the weekend showing that at this stage in his first term, George W. Bush had appointed twice as many judges, confirmed almost twice as many judges as President Obama's team has so far. And in particular, the U.S. attorneys, there are 94 of them around the country. These are clearly political appointments. The understanding is that politics are involved in the appointment, and it stops the day the person takes office. Well, we saw that under Bush, it didn't stop when they took office, and that Karl Rove and others were directing from Washington certain politically infused prosecutions, and that came to light with David Iglesias in New Mexico, who blew the whistle on a senator and congressperson who improperly tried to intervene and pressure him. So we know how politicized the U.S. attorneys were under the Bush administration, and it's bad policy, it's bad politics, and it's inexcusable that the Obama team has not demanded the resignations of the Republican appointees and allowed staffers to serve on an interim basis until they get around to choosing through the senatorial process who to put into those positions for the new administration. But here in November of the first year of the Obama presidency, there is no excuse that those Republicans are still serving and calling the shots, as you just pointed out, Governor.
Points I'd like to make. One is that you mentioned David Iglesias. David Iglesias is an honorable Republican who was serving as a U.S. attorney who would not play politics with the U.S. Attorney's Office in New Mexico. He was fired by the Roe Bush team. Well, the person at the Department of Justice who worked with Roe's minions to fire this guy, David Iglesias, and the person who worked with Roe's minions to replace him with somebody who would play ball with Karl Rove and the Bush administration is still at the Department of Justice. He is still the guy that is in control of the Department of Justice. He runs the Department of Justice on a daily basis. And it is inexcusable that this guy is still calling the shots on my case.
And who is that, sir?
I would rather not mention. I probably get myself in. I've already probably said more than I need to. But,
okay.
But this administration needs to open its eyes and get these people out of these positions. You know, get them away from places where they can continue to do damage to our system of justice. And anyway, it is frustrating for me. I have all but given up on the Department of Justice, and although I would encourage your listeners, if you have any sense of outrage, if you have any sense that there is an injustice being done, not only to me, but by leaving these Karl Rove prosecutors in place, two things you can do. One, you can go to a website that I set up, FireRoveProsecutors.com, and you can electronically send a message to members of Congress and to the White House, or you can pick up the phone or you can write and fax your congressmen and senators and tell them, get on Obama, President Obama, and tell him to get rid of these people. And let's try to straighten this Department of Justice out, not just for me, but if they can prosecute and put me through this kind of episode in my life, this investigation started in 1999. If they can do this to me as a governor, they can do it to you, folks. They can do it to your children or your husband or your wife or any family member or your friends. And it is wrong for the Department of Justice. It is wrong for government employees, federal prosecutors, to be able to go after somebody because they don't like them.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's me or somebody else, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, this kind of stuff needs to be stopped. And there's a lot more to be said, but I'll end with that note. But I very much appreciate your support and your allowing me to be on this show today.
Governor, I want to ask you about one other development. Greg Craig resigned as the White House counsel last week, and that plays into your case in a number of ways. First of all, the U.S. attorneys and judicial appointments are vetted through the White House counsel's office, and the failure to vacate the Republicans and appoint new U.S. attorneys is partly at the feet of the White House counsel. He also negotiated the deal for Karl Rove's specific and unusual circumstance testimony before the House Judiciary Committee, and maybe testimony is too strong a word, he was deposed under oath, and we still haven't seen much of the detail of the commentary that came from his deposition or his interrogation. And Greg Craig worked at Williams & Connolly, the juice law firm in Washington that he's expected to return to, and that same firm had represented Karl Rove. So many questions were raised about the objectivity of Greg Craig, and in particular, the deal that he cut with Karl Rove. So do you feel that there is potential for relief for you with Greg Craig out of the White House?
Let me say this. I take a different point of view on Greg Craig, and I want to say this only because I have known Greg Craig for over 40 years. I'm not saying I knew him well, but I knew him, and I have known him. And my impression of Greg Craig is that he is an honorable person, and that he is intellectually honest, and that he would not allow the fact that his firm represented Karl Rove in a book deal, or the fact that he represented United States Senator Richard Shelby from my state, to influence what he thought was in the best interest of the country. I just have a hard time believing that Greg Craig would be influenced by that. But that being said, I do think that there's something is wrong in Denmark, as they used to say. I mean, something's not right when a newly elected Democrat who runs on a platform of change allows the Rove prosecutors to remain in place around the country. There has been some deal struck somewhere. And as for this administration relying on United States senators to make recommendations for the replacement of Republicans, well, that's never going to happen in Alabama because our two United States senators are Republicans, and they don't like me. One of them was deeply involved in my prosecution, Jeff Sessions.
Mm-hmm.
It is no question in my mind that he played a role in my prosecution. He is never going to try to replace Lura Canary, ever. So for this administration not to remove these Rove prosecutors, one, it's just bad politics. Two, it's wrong. And three, I think it's going to bite them in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
At some point.
Yeah.
Because these people that they've left in place, they don't like Obama either.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they don't like any Democrats at any level. And they're gonna go after Democrats for as long as they remain in public office. And now what they're talking about, well, they've already replaced one prosecutor in Alabama with someone who used to work with the Republican United States Senator Jeff Sessions.
That's Alice Martin resigned, right?
Well, no, there was another one in Mobile, the Southern District is what I'm talking about now. They replaced the U.S. attorney with somebody who's closer to Jeff Sessions. But that doesn't do justice any good. That appeases these two Republican United States senators from Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, they may have struck a deal with Jeff Sessions saying, look, we'll let you appoint people in Alabama if you won't oppose Sotomayor. That's entirely possible. I mean, that's a political decision that they might make. They might say, look, we'll never get the electoral votes out of Alabama. They're never going to vote for President Obama. So what do we care about Sigelman or justice in Alabama? Let the Republicans have those U.S. attorneys, and we can you know, cut a deal with Jeff Sessions so he won't filibuster some of our nominees. But I don't know what's going on, but something is going on. And whatever it is not right, and it's not smart.
Yeah. Governor, before I let you go, how's your fundraising going, and what are the costs of this legal struggle that you're embroiled in?
It's cost me everything that I have earned throughout my life, everything that my wife and I have saved. My daughter is trying to, I'm still trying to help a little bit, but I haven't been able to. My daughter, Dana, who was my biggest cheerleader, she finished school in California, and she's now in graduate school in Cambridge, England. And, it's financially, it's caused a problem. I would welcome anyone who could contribute to my legal expense fund. I've got to hire another lawyer to argue my case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Should they grant what they call cert, mm-hmm. grant our petition to be heard.
Right.
And if they go to www.donsigelman, SIEGELMAN, donsigelman.com, or donsigelman.org, there'll be a place to donate, and I would certainly appreciate it.
Well, and I encourage my listeners to help out if you possibly can, because I think that this is a very important case. And if we can see justice prevail for Don Sigelman, it could open up many other locked boxes left over
Absolutely.
From the Bush-Cheney administration. And we deserve to know, and we deserve to right the ship to purge ourselves of these political operatives and return to constitutional rule. And I don't think that's too much to ask, Governor.
I don't think so either. It's supposed to be an administration of change. You know, we were drug into a war under false pretenses. We passed a Patriot Act and with the warrantless wiretaps. We mm-hmm. we allowed interrogations, which were turned into torture. We allowed elections to be stolen, and we've allowed the Department of Justice to be used as a tool, as a political weapon. We've sacrificed individual rights and liberties, and it's time to, if we want change, it's time to put something on the table.
Governor, stay in touch and keep fighting.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Don Sigelman, former Democratic governor of Alabama. That does it for this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your comments are welcome. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.